now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the great things about being a Christian, especially for a history geek like me, is that the faith is based on evidence. It is based on history. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who came to my attention as I was researching my presentation for the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. I kept looking for information about the ancient Near East, specifically the Ubaid culture and the Uruk culture, which followed it. As I tried to piece together what happened in history, which roughly corresponds with the very earliest chapters of the book of Genesis. I kept coming back to a blog related to a series of novels called the Raising Up Pharaoh epic. The author had done a lot of research, similar to what I'm doing, scooping up all the academic papers you can find on the internet and trying to make sense out of them, and then posting his findings to his site. It, carefully curated and well-organized, and it was a great help as I prepared for the conference. Began reading the novel and found that that's pretty good, too. The first of six is called Osgrinor, the first in the series called Raising Up Pharaoh. And we are pleased to welcome for the first time to the program Richard Burke, what we will call him as at his request. Rick. Rick, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm very excited about meeting you because I'm looking forward to your prose book on this subject.
Well, I'm trying to make sense out of it and not go beyond the evidence. There's a temptation, of course, to want to fit the evidence into preordained conclusions, and I don't want to go there. But as Christians, I don't believe we need to go there. But let's talk a little bit about the research that you pulled together. I mean, the Ubaid culture, we're talking about, 4 or 5,000 B.C.?
Yeah, it starts showing up about 6,000 B.C.
Okay.
Okay, and it fades out in 3800 B.C. At the time that the Uruk culture kind of kicked in and supplanted it. And I suspect it's the same folks, except they evolved in a direction. Well, they were dealing with larger and larger scale populations, and organizational complexity was changing then. They were under a lot of pressure at that time, and I'm sure there were a lot of migrants coming in who were not Ubaid by this time. It went from about 6,000 when they were coexisting with a Halaf culture, which was a little more northerly culture, time of Aryapatia, some of the most beautiful ceramics you'll ever find out of Mesopotamia, as far as I'm concerned. I just fell in love with it. As a matter of fact, I put Aryapatia stuff in my novels, just as something that was passed down from great-great-grandpa, okay, and that the little village of Aryapatia disappeared. Which was part of the Halaf culture, which was supplanted by the Ubaid.
Well, let's talk about, and just to give people the geographic idea, and I'll probably put a map up. If you're watching this on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, I'll put a map in here just for your reference. But we're talking about the Fertile Crescent, basically. The Ubaid culture, basically in southeast Iraq today, and then following the course of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers up to Syria and southern Turkey, and then also spread into western and northwestern Iran, and, you know, perhaps as far as the Armenian Mountains to the north, to the west as far as the Levant, perhaps, but mainly concentrated around southeastern Iraq, where we would find the ancient city of Ur and Uruk and Eridu. But again, to give you a visual, I'll put a map on screen so you can see it. I'll post a map with the show notes at vftb.net. Rick, your background, when I read your story, the About Us link, it doesn't appear to me that your background is as an archaeologist. What is your story and what led you to begin researching man's earliest origins?
I wanted to be an archaeologist as a kid. In fact, my parents planted a book strategically called The Romance of Archaeology. So I was dying to be an archaeologist, but unfortunately my father said, you can't make a living at that. and so I went on and, I went into the Marines. And then when I got out of the Marines, I took aeronautical engineering. I go way back, all right? This was when Kennedy was saying, we're going to put a man on the moon. I said, I got to be a part of that program. And I got good in the engineering. But by the time I got my degree, I realized they had designed the whole thing. And nobody had an appetite. I was part of the Star Trek generation. I mean, it was on TV when it showed up while I was in engineering school. So I just said, okay, then I'll go into the industry and I'll go into management in the industry. And actually had set a goal to run one of the major aerospace companies while I was a Marine. And that motivated me. And when I saw that engineering career path was not the best way to get what I wanted to do. And I want, you know, if there isn't a dream to do this, then I've got to get enough power to make a dream to do this. So I got a fellowship to Yale and got a master's in industrial administration there and went into shipbuilding with General Dynamics, who was real big at the time in space, putting a lot of rockets up anyway. And then the way the life works, if you don't stick to your original plan, they put me to building ships. And before I knew it, in a few years, I was running a shipyard. And after that, we designed a super ship and Citibank was involved in funding the thing. It was a three-way deal with Burma Oil and Libya. And the Citibank guys, I looked at them and I said, gee, here I am I start work at 7 o'clock in the morning, finish at 10:30 at night, and I'm doing this 7 days a week. At that time, I was not even a Christian. And I just said, gee, I think I want to know more about these guys. The next thing I got a recruiter's call and I ended up in banking. I was involved in banking in the U.S. and then South America and 6 years down in South America. Anyway, long story short, I was adrift from archaeology, which was my first love. But as my children mounted in number, I decided I'd take them on one of those once in a lifetime type trips The six of us went over to Greece, and then we did the Turkey coast, you know, Ephesus and the islands, Patmos and all that. And my oldest son got the bug, all right, from me. It was from me because we were there because I love this stuff. And I never stopped reading in archaeology. I just wasn't making a living at it. But he said, we had to bail because we were going to, things were getting hot. This was the time we had shot down, America had shot down an Iranian airliner.
Right.
And as we were just visiting Ephesus, and as I went out on deck for the trip to go into Ephesus, I noticed we were surrounded by a flotilla of the Turkish Navy. And I looked down, and being a former Marine, I recognized general quarters. All these guys had their helmets on and everything, these boats, and they were all snugged up next to us. And that was before I knew what had happened to the Iranian airliner. And then I said, oh, I understand. They don't want anything happening to us on their watch and in their territory. So we had to abort the trip because I wanted to go to Israel and Egypt at the time. And the times have never settled since then. I'm not going to go to until they get a little better grip on their security.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I got diverted.
My
oldest son became an archaeologist. He's a professor at UCLA and has a dig in Jaffa, Israel.
Okay.
So the bug has been passed on.
Well, he's digging in a fascinating place. I just talked with a young gentleman who is hoping to get to raise enough funding to become part of a dig on the Qumran Plateau, where they found another cave that has not yet been explored.
Yeah, I read that. Or I watched that last night.
Yeah.
Your interview with him.
Dr. Judkins. Yeah, he's a good young man. And he's working under Dr. Randall Price, who I had the opportunity to interview in Colorado Springs at the Prophecy Conference there. So he's one of the few Christians who's been allowed to dig in the Holy Land. So that's a good company your son is in there, and being able to work with the antiquities folks there in Israel. The fascination of the ancient Near East then, and going all the way back to the Ubaid culture, which if you're going to accept the timeline of say a literal creation and fall and then banishment from the Garden of Eden, the Ubaid culture and the Halafa culture would have to follow pretty quickly after that. And I know that archaeologists would say, well, no, that didn't happen. We've got, you know, remains that go far older than that. Okay, yeah, I understand that. But we're still looking at the point in history in which humans suddenly in Iraq, of all places, today, developed cities almost, it seems, overnight. When you started reading into this, why did you pick this period of history for study, and what in your study did you find most intriguing about that period of history?
Oh, it's another side to me. When I was going to the University of Maryland studying aeronautical engineering, I was run top of my class. I could take anything I wanted, and I took creative writing, and the English department wanted me to jump into the English department because my writing was received very well, and they said, you should be a writer. And I said, no, I'm in the top of my class, and I'm finishing my sophomore year, and I am going to get to be an engineer. And so that was one of those roads that I, you know, where you have a fork, and I chose the road I took. I have no qualms about that. But as I was reaching a point where I could retire, I wasn't interested in full-time golf or all that, the usual retirement stuff.
Right.
Just looking at the road I did not take. And I said, gee, I can start over here. But in doing that, I asked the Lord. I said, Lord, I've been working in such a disciplined way. I was a CEO of companies and stuff like that. And you work in a different sort of way. It's very creative, but it's a different kind of creativity. And the storyteller, I was a storyteller when I was a kid. I used to walk through the woods with my buddies, and I'd spin stories real time about us. And always the foes were these wild girls. But anyway, I was a natural storyteller from the beginning. But I asked the Lord, I said, I kind of feel like I burned out that kind of creative bent I had back then. And I said, I need a plot, and I need an idea, and I need inspiration from you. I know you can recreate anything on the spot. I mean, as a matter of fact, the naming of us as Christians on the basis of Jesus dying on the cross is a decision by God. I mean, it's a decision. And as a matter of fact, Paul addresses that. He says that, you know, that God can call my child, that those who are not my children. When I asked God for some inspiration, he just said, well, let's start with this. Okay. And I, you know, he does, it's not a dialogue like you and me talking.
Mm-hmm.
He's loud and clear because, I mean, I'm the Holy Spirit is in you and he's in me. And the guidance for me is very, very clear. And the responses. He said, well, you know, look at the Exodus when Moses is standing in front of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's, you know, saying, who are you? Why should I listen to you? And Moses says, the Lord says, I raised you up to show my glory. Okay.
Hmm.
And from that, I saw that he was saying that to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh means the big house.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And the big house didn't start with that Pharaoh. So if God raised up Pharaoh, then there's a story there. Okay. And starting with that and a second, the need for the second part of it came as I really started getting going. And that was the Canaanites, or really the Amorites, mm-hmm. both of them. When Abraham was in the land and being promised the land, he said, and God said, but you're not going to get it immediately. All right, it's going to be a while because the sins of the Amorites are not complete.
Right, right. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and so all of a sudden I said, "Jay, what we've got here is these Amorites are backsliding, and they're backsliding down into a precipice." Okay,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The precipice is not here yet. Okay, and so we know the story of 400 years or whatever that it took before they finally came in and took the land. But those two inspirations sent me propelled back into it seemed like a natural to me. Because there's a lot of stuff in Egypt that has architectural features that started back with the Ubaid, like the the architecture of the, what do they call it, recessed wall,
mm-hmm.
A buttress and wall, periodic buttresses. You can find that all over Egypt, and especially on the early graves of the pre-dynastic and the early dynastic pharaohs. That's how I got into the story, and I had my son, and his wife's an archaeologist too, as at least moral supporters and somewhat guides, just to get me to the fundamental books to get started. And that's how I got in deeper and deeper and deeper. You don't write a story like what I wrote unless you have to research the background. And unfortunately, there was a war going on where my story still is.
Yeah.
And, but that got me doing research on an archaeology basis. The only places I've really had boots on the ground to visit that are in the mainstream of my story where my people put boots on the ground was Ashkelon and Gedi. There's a wonderful Chalcolithic temple, which, you know, most people go to En Gedi, and especially guys who are as old as me, they don't really look up, but there is a Mazar excavated a Chalcolithic temple that goes back to the fourth millennium in parallel with the Uruk civilization, and even the end of the Ubaid. And so anyway, you climb about 500 feet up a cliff. I mean, you literally have to walk a ledge about a foot wide, and they have this cable built into the wall so that you can climb it. And my son and I went up there, and that fit into my story. Interesting thing is, you don't need to have boots on the ground in a lot of places to get a feel for them. All you need to do is look at Google Map and do the zoom.
Yeah, yeah. Now, for people not familiar with En Gedi, and I'm looking this up in real time as we're talking, I did not realize that there was a temple 3500 BC on the west shore of the Dead Sea.
Yeah.
Which is where En Gedi is located.
Yeah, the Nahal Mishmar hoard of bronze goods. You can look at that. Nahal. Mishmar, Mishmar, I believe, and they found a trove of bronze work stuck in a cave not far from this temple, and they figure that they're that they were contemporaries, and there was all kinds of scepters and stuff like that in there.
Yeah, I'm looking at a replica of one of the bronze scepters right now. That's remarkable, thinking that that's like 5,500 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's another thing. The Chalcolithic Age, which was really the transition from Neolithic to the Bronze Age. First you got to have copper, and that's what Chalcolithic was when they were first started digging copper. And right between En Gedi and What do we call it? Down to the Elat, down by Elat.
Mm-hmm.
Between those is the copper mines, and the I was in a Neolithic or Chalcolithic copper mine where you go down there. It's a major national park now, but the mines there are. It's a surface of malachite, which is where you, which is one of the ores that you can produce copper out of. Then at the time, they were digging, looking for veins of copper, because they, you know, and but they learned during that process how to over the. I think the first copper mine there was about 5,000 BC.
Hmm,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
And they've now got a ladder down the ground. And Nancy didn't go down, but I went down the ladder and took some pictures on the inside of one of these mines. I mean, they just bored their way through the malachite, just like solid malachite, and just bored their way down. And then they would tunnel out following the veins in various directions. And after you've gone about 30 feet, you need some air, more fresh air, so they just bore up, and until they could fresh air could fall in there, and mm-hmm. It's all tunneled. And the count, but it's a little muddied since because the Egyptians took advantage of this, and brought an industrial scale to it. But there are, I don't know, thousands. I know there are thousands. I'd say maybe 5,000 different air holes. Okay, to go down in there. Hmm. They've only excavated the part. They excavated enough of them so that you could go down, you know, anybody that wanted to could go down the ladder and look at it on the inside.
Hmm.
So and the reason I bring that up is because that was a hotbed of copper technology development. I mean, they had the stuff you looked at, the scepter head, you know, that's one of the first places in the world where they developed the lost wax. You don't make those copper those scepter heads without the lost wax process.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's there's a lot of talk about, you know, how, you know, I was further up in Northern Europe. Well, they can. Yeah, they can say that, but they don't have any earlier dates, you know. So I imagine this spread around pretty quick as anybody who had a copper mace head was in much better shape than somebody who had a rock.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. As you know, one of the constants in human history is that the military always drives innovation.
Leads technology.
Yeah. Well, so the civilization that developed then, the Ubaid culture, which again just sort of still sprung up overnight with the first cities, and I know that there's that Jericho is sort of designated the first settlement, possibly the oldest settlement in the world, but the oldest city, you know, planned city with streets and a class of the population that didn't have to go out and work in the fields because they were being supported by, you know, people who were doing that, you know, the clerical class or the priestly class or whatever, really developed the Ubaid culture. What were its characteristics? And again, how does this relate to the history that we read in the Bible in terms of, you know, are the biblical accounts consistent and so forth?
Well, they're consistent. There's not an inconsistency here, is what I would say. I mean, there is a, you know, it was a very unfortunate thing. Oh, let me just make it go away.
The Ubaid culture, and you know what were its characteristics?
There is not an inconsistency. It's unfortunate that a lot of Christians have been misled. Augustine told Christians around the time of the fall of Rome, don't get involved in arguing in physical matters, okay? And here we are arguing about are, and it's a major obstacle. As an evangelist, I'm an evangelist. You're an evangelist too. In evangelism, we have to be careful about what we deny and the way that we deal with people who have science is given to us by God. It's His creation.
Right, right.
I mean, everything we've done, all the great stuff we've done, put a man on the moon, all that, He showed us. And the early guys were really making the breakthroughs into the science and into science. We're all very strong Christians.
Right.
And, you know, and there was no inconsistency there. Somehow, Augustine saw that this was always a threat, was that we were going to alienate ourselves from the world by making statements that and it is revelation. Science is finding down lower and lower detail levels. Mm-hmm. And also on a macro expansion of the universe, the realization of how big it is, how big God's creation is. These guys are not running counter to us. They're just saying what they see. And I learned the scientific method as an engineer, mm-hmm. really in spades. I don't know how we got walked into this corner of arguing that there's a conflict between discovering God's creation in greater detail. And you notice God gave it to us. And you notice how we are able to use it in practical ways. It's all been put there. I mean, it's all designed from the beginning on creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the argument, you know, well, gee, you know, it gets down to both sides become religious. Okay. I mean, first off, as we well know, Jesus told us, and we've got to remember this, that nobody comes to me except the Father calling.
Amen. All right.
Okay. And He didn't call me till I was 35. Okay. And I don't, if you're breathing, I have hope. I've seen conversions at 88. Okay.
But don't ever bank on it. Yeah.
There's no, in my mind, there's not the slightest argument. I never even thought about it. When I became a Christian because the Father called me, and He called me in a way that Jesus all of a sudden was plunk. Here He is. And I, as an ex-Marine, I wanted to salute. Okay. This is the leader I'd always been looking for. But there was never any there was no break in my background. I mean, science to me is just a gift from God of giving us the faculties to be able to bore down into His creation and take advantage of all this stuff that we didn't know that was there.
Amen. You know, yep.
How about oil and gas? I mean,
yeah.
You know, as examples, and steel and everything. I mean, it's all good. And it was all there. And we didn't mandate, even the most wild-eyed scientist can't claim he made it. Okay.
That's right.
They may argue that because they haven't been called to Jesus yet, that they may argue that there's no proof that there's a God behind it. But they have to make that argument that everything always was. All right. And it's kind of a silly argument on its own, and not only that, as science works its way out and gets better and better, and then we start to be able to understand the redshift and stuff like that, and we see our expanding universe, then guess what? You can take it back with Galileo's work backwards to where it started, and it all started, and they're stuck with this argument they've created that it all came out of a unity, a point. Only a mathematical construct of a point infinitesimally small.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, they call it the Big Bang, and we call it the creation. Let there be light.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Boy, was there light.
Yeah. The funny thing is that because of that, now they are making the argument that, the steady-state universe really does have some theory, does have some merit. So they're trying to go back to that.
Yeah, well, that's going to be a real stretch.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
But we've got to be careful as Christians that we don't stretch either.
Right.
And we don't ignore, and we And we don't look at science as an enemy, but as an opportunity given to us by God to use the creation to its greater extent. So there's no, you know, so when I'm waiting back there in the Ubaid swamp, okay, I start recognizing things that frankly, the Ubaid Ophidian characters, when I saw those figurines, I said, holy moly.
Yeah.
You know, here is evidence what looks like, the first thing that came to my mind was a snake. And the first thing that I thought about the most impressive ones are the woman holding her, or the female holding a nursing infant.
Right.
An Ophidian head. Ophidian, for the readers, it just means snake-like.
Mm-hmm.
And snake-like heads. They could also be said to look like lizards, but a lizard's head and a snake head.
pretty close, yeah.
Pretty close, right. So anyway, when I saw that, I just said, gee, there's more here than I was looking for, but there's a great story here. That's my next story. I mean, and that's why I'm interested in your nonfiction account, and because you're just since I've encountered you, I am learning a whole lot of stuff that I didn't know about, which will give me very good background. You know, I'm a novelist, so I can take things and fit them. But I'm not doing, you know, I'm not, first, it's not historical fiction. I mean, people that write historical fiction are held to a standard that sometimes is absurd, like your train schedule wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No, really.
Sure.
They can't do that with me.
No, my wife is writing that right now. She's writing a series based in Victorian England, and so she's being very careful to make sure that the weather is correct, what happened. She's using Jack the Ripper as a backdrop against some of the plot points, and so she's got to make sure that she's got all of the details from the Ripper murders, because there are Ripperologists out there who will hold her feet to the fire.
Exactly.
So, but she really gets into that. She's really enjoying it. In fact, she's we're hoping we can travel to the UK next year to see some of those sites firsthand. But I understand what you're saying. There are certain liberties you can take when you're not trying to write historical fiction that you...
I can't. I am writing as accurately as I can based on all the papers that, like, you and I are accumulating. But the research is, first off, archaeologists often don't collect the dots. Even bother to connect the dots,
right?
Unless they can do a peer-reviewed something that can stand a peer review, and I respect that. That's being scientific, and I'm collecting all these dots, all right. And I'm hoping you're going to give me some more with your book, but I want to get mine done by next year. So you say you're working to some deadline around or.
Hoping to get it done by the end of the year. Right. Right.
Yeah, that'll be great. I recognize that, I'm getting close to Eden here. And because they're still worshiping this, the snake, they're not just female figures. They're also our male.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Too. They're just not as numerous as the female figures.
Mm-hmm.
I even saw where she's holding a suckling baby it looked to me like it's gotten to the point where Satan is worshipped and the people identify more with the satanic than they do. You know, not only did they have the rebellion. But I mean, Cain's side didn't ever, there was no evidence, at least we have no evidence of any reformation.
Right.
But it's a good side too. And I imagine there's some of both have probably come out of that. To me, the Persian Gulf Valley is where's the great melting pot. At the end of the Ice Age, it's called a refugia. There are papers, you'll find those academic, I refer to them, in the blog post.
Mm-hmm.
Refugia are during the glacial maximum. There were either the weather was not stable. And at the end of the ice age, it was really unstable because the winds were winds were starting to go crazy. Whereas, you know, it was kind of a stability of death with the ice age hanging over, at least up in the northern hemisphere. But people were, first off, there was obviously a traffic of people going east. And they were driven back, the ones short of the Himalayas, that hadn't gotten past there into you know, later on into China. They would in some of these extremely volatile weather situations, they were, you know, I untold, we'll know in heaven, all right,
mm-hmm, the ones
that didn't make it over the Himalayas to China. Okay, and a lot of them died. I mean, sort of like, you know, sort of like the story in California where the whole...
Oh, the Donner Party and some of the... Yeah.
The wagon train died.
Mm-hmm,
Anyway, but the refugia idea is that some of these gravitated to this relatively benign, you know, when it's really, really cold and it's only cold, that's a refuge.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so that valley, which, you know, the Persian Gulf, all of it was exposed. It was just an extension of the Tigris-Euphrates water flow.
Mm-hmm.
And water flow coming out of all places, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula,
mm-hmm.
Which was at that time savanna, not desert, during the pluvial. The pluvial is the period of the big rains, because during the Ice Age, this place was severely dry also. But as the Ice Age came to an end, water went back into the air, as did the 10 million cubic miles, yes, I calculated it, of fresh water that came out of the melting glaciers that raised the sea 500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
The Persian Gulf Valley, all the way down, almost all the way to the Indus River, was dry, and the Indus River existed at the time. There was, you know, there was a civilization there. I think they might better have called the Fertile Crescent to have extended down to the Indus River, because they were contemporary.
Hmm.
It's just the Indus River culture, because one of the reasons we don't know anything about the Indus culture is their language has never been decoded.
Oh, okay.
But they would have been part of that. I mean, there was a big interaction between the Indus River and Mesopotamia, and it was clear by the historic period, which started about 3000 BC. Anyway, so out of that refuge, as the weather warmed up and the oceans rose, the people that were in that refuge went upriver, and actually, in fact, they went several different ways. And I kind of tracked the rootstock of the Ubaid by their pottery, and they had a pottery which is called brown on buff. Or black on buff, and it's a buff background with starts out as squiggles and gets fancier and more geometric as it goes along. But the people that were in that Persian Gulf Valley, Mesopotamia, really,
mm-hmm.
That were driven out. The pastoralists went up into Iran, because Iran is a kind of perfect kind of a place for pastoralists, because again, in the winters they can be down the lowlands along the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
and in the summer when it gets hot, and the Gulf, of course, is not fresh water, they can move up into highlands, the usual pastoral routine. And the hunters went out on that savanna on the south side of the Gulf as the waters rose, and because that was still a savanna. And not only that, it got better because during this period that this was happening, rains, which were absolutely unknown in the area during the Ice Age itself, really just lushed up. To our thoughts of what Saudi Arabia looks like now, no way. I mean, there were rivers, there were pastoralists up there also, besides the hunter gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
But the farmers, and this is where the Yuba that really interests you and me, out of that rootstock that was in that valley, they just kept following as the sea rose. You can't plant anything in seawater, but you can. They just kept following the new delta as it rose 500 feet over maybe 5,000 years until they ended up. Till the water stopped rising. That's mm-hmm. what really made them stop at around Eridu and Ur. And they are the founders of Eridu and Ur.
Mm-hmm.
And the beginnings, that's where they really took stock. But, you know, don't think they stopped there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Ubaid influence went all the way as far up to northern Syria.
Right.
And we should remember that. I mean, there was a lot more interaction than we think, just because we and the archaeologists are good at seeing they're digging in Israel or digging in Syria. They say, gee, that's a Ubaid pot. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it was brought there from southern Mesopotamia. It meant that some Ubaid folks had either immigrated or intermarried or whatever reason had ended up there, and that pottery was in there, you know, just a style. It's just a style. I mean, everybody was basically making the same fabric of pottery, you know, a little mud, got some good clay, and put something in there to temper it, whether it's grass or straw, as we're a famous story in the Bible. Making bricks. The concentrated group of Ubaid culture that we're talking about, it's not like these guys were by definition just a small tribe or people group down there. It's really a culture, and I love and I recommend, and we talked about it. I keep referring to it through this whole, the 14 blog posts that I have on the Ubaid.
Mm-hmm.
I keep referring to what I consider to be the core document available to all of us from bless that university, right? University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Now they're in the news because they said, you don't come here and get away from.
That's right. No safe spaces here. Yeah.
No safe spaces here. What is that word? Mess. You know, none of that tapping of the finger. You know, there's going to be. We're going to get into a bad area here. So anybody doesn't feel like listening to this, they can leave.
That's right. You're going to be triggered.
University of Chicago just came. I'm so proud of them. I mean, you know, that could be the turning point. Actually.
Well, they're an influential institution, and they have been leading the way on research in the ancient Near East, for decades, for generations. So
yep.
Hopefully, because of the standards that they set and the respect and the prestige that the University of Chicago has in the academic world, maybe this will set a new tone.
Even the story of Indiana Jones, you know, he's supposed
right.
to be a graduate of the University of Chicago.
Right.
So when my son was there, he called, you know, he got the nickname moniker Missouri Burke. Because, I mean, he was so into it, right? I mean, for his age group, Indiana Jones was a big deal.
Sure,
right?
Sure. So, and this is fascinating, and I've read this theory before. In fact, there's a professor just up the road from us here in Southwest Missouri, Missouri State University, who holds this belief that the Garden of Eden, or the culture at least that preceded the Ubaid culture, is beneath the waters of the Persian Gulf today.
Oh, yeah, they know that.
And the reason then that the Ubaid culture appears to, you know, seems to appear fully formed is because the evidence of all of the preliminary stages leading up to cities and writing were underneath the waters of the Persian Gulf. That's why we can't find the evidence.
Which is not a good place to explore right now.
No, it isn't. You've got Iranian gunboats challenging U.S. Navy destroyers. That's not a safe place to be. That is interesting. And I'm looking at an article now from about 6 years ago at livescience.com that's got a really good map based on the theories of an anthropologist and archaeologist. So I'll include that in the show notes as well. I'll flag that for use in the show notes. So the culture, as you describe it in your first novel, which I'm about 2/3 of the way through, Osgrenor, and I'll ask you in a moment about where you came up with that name.
I'll tell you right now, Osgrenor.
Osgrenor, okay.
Because I use Proto-Indo-European word roots to construct a lot of the character names and the towns.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the original Sumerian language, they pick the linguists pick up strains of. There's even a Indo-European strain in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not big, but it's there. And if you look at Proto-Sumerian, you look it up. Look up the subject Proto-Sumerian, and go through just the Wikipedia on it. You'll see the different strains of language that they pick up in Proto-Sumerian. So which also was a clue for me as I built my people and my hero. And that clue was that this was a composite. The Ubaid stock was influenced by people coming from other places. The Ubaid got agriculture going. They figured out how to intensively work what was a rotten piece of land but had two rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And they exploited that to the point until finally it really became a bad piece of land because it started to salt up. The intensive irrigation is the first place that we know of that was so productive and got increasingly productive that it started to have surpluses. When you have surpluses, the poor old hunter gatherers who never had anything but hard scrabble life looking for the next meal,
mm-hmm.
All of a sudden we've got people who can be freed up because people are producing for two and then three and then four, and then you start having craftsmen. You start specializing in pottery, specializing in this new metal that they're finding, copper,
mm-hmm.
And in all kinds of specialties. I mean, that was a huge opening for mankind. Was the recognition of or the creation of all the crafts,
mm-hmm.
and it depended completely upon excess agricultural production, and that started there, and there isn't any question about that.
Mm-hmm. And again, that led to the beginning of the stratification of society, where you had the government class and the priestly class, and the beginnings of these.
Think about what happens as you start out. You got 100 guys come, and then it's 1,000, and then it's 10,000, and Uruk ended up being nearly 100,000 within walls of and walls were interesting that they started showing up, and it wasn't just to keep floodwaters off the property,
right?
But there is a certain vein in archaeology that believes that everything, every cultural thing came from the spot where we found it. And also wants to believe that that they were pacifists at the time. I mean,
right.
I couldn't think of more violent people than hunter gatherers.
Yeah.
You wanted more. As you build up the population, and you just think about it, about trying to maintain peace, because if you're, if you're one of these, and there's always going to be somebody who thinks he's an elite, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. The elites, which are probably the first super farmers, all right, who started to learn how to have other people work for them, they built up wealth, and they want to. If you've got this you know, let's just say we're just at 10,000 now, okay? But the violence is a big issue with men, okay? And you put 10,000 people together, and you're going to have violence. If you have violence, though, and five guys get killed, and you're the guy who, you know, has these guys working for you, and you're and not only that, every one of these five guys now is able to produce three times as much as he needs to feed himself and his family. Well, your violence is unacceptable, even to, you know, to the budding elite.
Mm-hmm.
And the budding elite realizes that the only way, well, the need is there, and you know, and God has created us and with the intelligence that learns it, that leans towards finding solutions to problems it recognizes. Once we recognize a problem, we're really great. You know, for a long time, we just don't recognize it, like disease. I mean, until somebody looked under a microscope, you know, they really didn't know what they were working with.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about it, and it's easy for me because I got this writer's mind, right? I can imagine the churn of, you know, we all have a vision in our mind of what a miner's camp looked like during the gold rush in California, right? Well, you know, as everybody starts, but we don't ever have an idea of a 10,000 of these miners in one place.
Right.
Because people are gravitating now as the excess food is being produced and there's opportunities for people to do things that, you know, that are absolutely new to the world. The very idea of specializing in something other than finding the next meal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the violence had to be controlled. And to do that, the elites realized that they had to have structure. They had, first off, I imagine they had a little army, right? And they'd send this little army around patrolling the areas around until finally around got to be the whole area. And, you know, and there could be a lot of stories in there about how many little fiefdoms were among the 10,000 before one. There was only one.
Yeah, yeah.
that's how complexity developed. And this is the first place it happened, because it's the first place that had enough people that it had to happen. And there are other characteristics of the Ubaid, but that was a big one. Another big one was cemeteries.
Right,
you get buried one time, okay? Before that, the idea, a very common way of handling bodies was, first off, it was even figured out when villages were smaller, not good to have bodies around the house. And so they would put them out. Some of them made a sort of like a monument where they'd put the body and the vultures would come and pick it clean. And then they would then come in maybe a year later when it was nice and neat and the bodies were sun bleached. They would come in and get the bodies and put them in the ossuary idea, where mm-hmm. they'd put them in a box or something, or just bury the bones, but they wouldn't bury the body. But the Ubaid were the first one that said, you know, oh, well, they didn't say anything. We don't know what they said, but they did practice. And they started having centralized cemeteries, and it was one burial from the get-go, and that's when we first start seeing the bodies laying in and grave goods. But they didn't go crazy on the grave goods. It mm-hmm. was there was a little differentiation, but there were either no grave goods, which is probably the norm, or a couple of pots. But they weren't, you know, it took a long time to get to the idea. You had to develop a theology that somehow you could take stuff with you, right?
Yeah, right, right.
We don't see hearses anymore with a U-Haul behind them. But anyway, that was a major breakthrough. Another characteristic of the Ubaid was what was called a tripartite house. And just think of it this way: build a wall around the outside of whatever it is you're calling your home, and then build a central, usually open, inside, with, let's just figure it's a let's make it a shoebox type wall. I mean, about, you know, just a rectangular thing. Then you put the bedrooms and the kitchen and all the stuff down in little rooms along the sides, the long side. All right. And then down at the end, you have a big room. Okay. And the big room, in some houses would be, like they'd maybe have a little shrine and, but it was, probably lasted, not everybody would put a big shrine in there, but that would be their big room. But the temples took the same, format.
Hmm.
So that they, at the end of the temple, it's called the tripartite architecture. And it is the idea that you have a central courtyard with functioning offices and storage and whatever down each side. And then the worship center, with the whatever kind of images, if they have images or just a standing stone or something, down in the big room down at the end. And that is a U of A invention, and it lasted all the way through the Uruk civilization and on, in this Sumerian culture for another several thousand years. And
yeah,
it all started with a tripartite.
And I understand that the one of the reasons they know that there were Semites living in northern Egypt during the 18th through the 15th century, or well, 16th century BC, the period of the Hyksos, is because of the introduction of the tripartite house, or what they call the Syrian architecture, that came in from Canaan, which had not been in Egypt, at least not that part of Egypt at that period in time. It's interesting as we look at the developments that came out of the that part of the world, ancient Sumer, even before it was Sumer, we're 6,000-7,000 years ago, and yet we still somehow believe in our modern world that those humans were so primitive that they didn't quite understand the supernatural influences on their world, that they invented gods in order to explain things that they were just too simple to understand, like thunder and the changing of the seasons and, you know, death. And yet they came up with these amazing developments, which are almost mind-boggling. I mean, just imagine inventing language from scratch or inventing writing from scratch. And yet we're supposed to believe that they were too stupid to understand when something that couldn't be explained naturally was occurring.
Yeah, well, you know, that's part of that is our, I'm sorry to say, our schooling system. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I wasn't educated on this.
Normally,
I didn't really understand that Mesopotamia was the, I mean, we knew from the early 1900s with Woolley and all the others about this, and it was a hot topic at the time. I mean, people were migrating, or not migrating, they were, tourists were flocking to southern Mesopotamia to Woolley's Dig and the other stuff that was being dug there. But somehow it didn't get in the fabric of, of our education system. And I really don't understand it, but probably well, there are a lot of things that don't work into the education system. But there, let's get back on, if you want,
sure,
back on the U-Bait.
Sure.
What are some of the other characteristics? Well, there is the, they've come up with at Eridu, as we've discussed, or I don't think we've discussed on air, the Ophidian figurines.
Right.
This was a religious thing, and it was related to from the Ubaid times. They had an equivalent of Olympus. I mean, of the what Americans are more familiar with, the Roman and the and Greek gods.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their own, and there was a It seemed, and my feel through the whole thing was that they started out with a creator god, and I'm not, I you know, I how will I know for sure, but the one called An, mm-hmm. or sky god, mm-hmm. was originally in charge. I mean, he was number one, and the other demons, well, these creatures, they don't relate to, you know, like thunder and lightning and stuff like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. They relate to something more fundamental, something that goes back to something that they call the kind of a creation. They recognized the kind of creation, and there was a basic kind of a codification of the mating of a sky god and a water goddess, mm-hmm. And from that preceded everything. But it was a clear idea that there was a start.
Mm-hmm.
There was a start, and you know, because what we're really talking about. Now, the big argument today is it always was, or it was created, or don't think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Thick snort. they were recognized from the Ubaid period at the Eridu Temple was this Enki god.
Right, right. Fascinating character.
Huh?
He's a fascinating character.
Yeah, really. And they underneath they were surrounded by a half fresh water, half diluted salt water marsh.
Marsh.
Good word for that. Yeah, but there's another word. I should know it from my days in California. But underneath that. They knew that underneath there was a water table of fresh water,
mm-hmm.
and they called that the Abzu, and which was a trace of that mother goddess that they said was at the beginning of the universe.
Right, Tiamat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not. You're better on the names than I am. I pull them off because I figure I know where these guys came from. Enki was only one. Enlil was another one. They had Inanna. They all of these grew through history, through the other later civilizations, till you get to the Roman pantheon. I mean, in one way or another, they are related. Inanna is sort of the lover. The Venus.
She became Ishtar, who became Astarte, who became Aphrodite, who became Venus.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right. And there's a chain like that in my mind on all of them.
I agree.
I was a Hellenophile for a long time before I became a Christian. And, and I was very familiar with the Olympic gods and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that. I just saw that these were recognizable as far back as this time. And for you and me, it's kind of a no-brainer where they came from. All right, they fell from heaven, and were cast down to the earth, and they took over, and under Father God's the Creator's plan, they're allowed to do this. And even Jesus called Satan the prince of this world.
Right.
Although people like to think it's changed, what's changed is our opportunity in all of this. By being called to get out of this mess and be with God for eternity.
Right, right.
But it's easy to recognize this. It was just deja vu as I except for these Ophidians. I mean, we're really getting basic here with these Ophidians.
And again, finding that they were concentrated, there have only been about 150 of those found, but they were concentrated around Eridu, which is where you had this temple, the E-Abzu, the House of the Abyss, mm-hmm. where you had the God of the Abyss, En-Ki, whose name means Lord, En-Ki, Earth, Lord of the Earth, God of this world, Prince of this world. It's a pretty clear line when you connect those dots from Eridu circa 3500 BC all the way to, you know, first century Judea. It's pretty clear that you're dealing with the same entity, more than likely. And to find all of those snake-like or lizard-like figurines clustered around Eridu, just that's the only explanation that makes a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. No, they moved upriver and they became a spontaneous civilization because everything else was covered by the sea.
Right, right.
Or you'd be able to track the growth from primitive to advanced agriculture. Mm. It did just spring out of nothing.
Yeah.
That's my view of the Ubaid, and to me. The thing that really captures my mind is these Ophidians and what that kind of, there's a kind of a, gee, you look at one of the Ophidian, I wish we had one here. You'll have one on your.
Right. I'll put one on the screen and in the show notes so people can see what we're talking about.
Mama Ophidian with the little, right. little. Lizard or snake.
I had several of them displayed during my presentation at the Morningside Church here a few weeks back.
They were called snakeheads in the beginning, and now, you know, Ophidian is a more academic name
right.
for them.
Well, Rick, I know we've only scratched the surface of this topic, but I try to keep these programs to about an hour just to keep them to a manageable length for viewers and listeners, and also limited amount of memory when rendering video on the computer here. But if you're willing, I'd love to continue conversation sometime, maybe take it up into the Uruk period.
Yeah, anytime.
All right, and I'll share some notes. I'll shoot you a copy of the paper with the article I saw, the paper that I saw on the cranial deformation at Eridu.
Yeah, we didn't even get into that.
Right, because that is something, well, we'll have to do a little more study on that and compare notes on that, because if that is accurate, what I think I remember reading, that people were trying to turn their children into little clones of the Ophidian figurines. And again, there's some significance there that's got to go beyond just the cosmetic.
Oh, the figurine is just representative of something.
Okay. Right. Right. Absolutely. And the question is, what is it? When you look at the word Nakash in the Bible, which is the word that is applied to the rebel in Eden, and understand that's the word translated serpent, but it's also used in the books of Isaiah and Numbers interchangeably with seraph, the root word of seraphim. You realize that the rebel in Eden was not a talking, walking snake. Rick, where do people find your novels, the Raising Up Pharaoh series?
They're on Amazon, and I highly recommend if they take the Kindle version, all right, which I I'll just make a plug for Amazon, and I have no stock, all right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way to read now.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Got my Kindle right here.
Especially novels, my pen name is R E J Burke. If you just put that in Google, it'll take you to it.
Yep. Well, the show notes will have a link to your website and also a link to the Amazon author's page so people can see all six of the novels there in the series. The first one being Ausgrinnor and continuing through number six, which is, how would I pronounce that? Maati?
Maati.
Maati.
Just Maati.
Okay. Rick Burke, R.E.J. Burke, the author of the Raising Up Pharaoh series and a fellow history geek. Enjoyed the conversation. We could continue on for... well, quite a while, but unfortunately, I've got 45 minutes to finish today's daily update for Skywatch TV, so I got to get that finished up. But we will talk again, I promise.
I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Check the show notes at vftb.net. And if you're watching this on the web, you'll find the show notes at the YouTube video file. The YouTube channel is youtube.com/ Derek Gilbert, youtube.com/DerekGilbert. R.E.J. Burke, Richard Burke, Rick Burke, if you're on a first name basis. Six novels written in the ancient Near East and the period of history before the invention of writing, about 5,300 years ago. So we're talking about 3,300 B.C., just prior to the flood of Noah. And according to the website, Rick has spent over 30,000 hours in research in order to make these novels as realistic as possible for the people who lived in the world that he created. If you look at the maps that he includes with the first novel, which I'm reading, Ausgrinnar, you will recognize the terrain if you're familiar with the geography of the ancient Near East. And the city of Ausgrinnar is a stand-in for the ancient city of Eridu, which I would argue is the most important city of the ancient Near East, prior to Jerusalem being designated as the site of God's eternal home. Yahweh has declared that Jerusalem and Mount Zion are his, and that's where he's going to reign forever and ever. But prior to that, during the time that the Watchers walked among us on a regular basis, Eridu and the cult center of Enki at Eridu were hugely influential on the ancient Near East. And I would argue even more important than Babylon was Eridu. So recommend the novels and look forward to talking to Rick again, because we're sharing an interest here. And I'm pleased to say, if I can pat myself on the back, that I was able to share some of the research with Rick that I pulled together for my presentation at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference that he wasn't familiar with. And one of the things that I found fascinating, and this is why I think the end of the conversation we had here, the very last 15 minutes or so, talking about Eridu and these ophidian or snake-like, lizard-like figurines that have been dug out of the ground around Eridu. They're concentrated around Eridu and at the nearby city of Ur, which was also a very important early city in ancient Sumer. That's the only location that we found these, and they happen to be around the city that was the holy city to Enki. Enki was one of the three most important Sumerian gods, along with Enlil, and I would argue Inanna. Anu was the chief god, sort of like El in the Canaanite pantheon, but Enlil, the storm god, and Enki, whose name means Lord of the Earth. And I would suggest that you compare that against the title Jesus used when he referred to Satan, prince of this world, or god of this world. He was the god of his temple was called the Eabzu, the house of the aquifer, or house of the Abzu, and Abzu is the Sumerian word, or Akkadian word, from which we get the word abyss. So, there was a dig at Eridu back in 1947-48, and they found about 1,000 graves there, people buried during the Ubaid period, which again preceded the Uruk period, which was Nimrod's period, preceded the invention of writing. And of the 1,000 graves, they exhumed 206 sets of remains, and all 206, every single one, had a deformed cranium, a conehead cranium. Now, the scholar who led the dig back in 1947 said that he thought it was due to earth pressure, that all, you know, I mean, 206 out of 206, 100% of the skulls there were deformed, were deliberately deformed, but he said it was probably due to earth pressure. Modern scholars are reexamining those claims and pointing out that if they had been deformed due to the pressure of the earth after burial, they would probably have been cracked or broken or misshapen in a non-symmetrical way, which appears not to be the case with these 206 sets of remains. Furthermore, there are other scholars who are looking at other ancient civilization sites from the Ubaid period, and we're talking now about 10,000 BC up to about 5,500 BC, and found that all around the ancient Near East, from western Iran to the Levant, like Jericho and sites in what are now modern Lebanon and Syria, every single site where they've exhumed human remains dated to that period of history in that part of the world show examples of deliberate cranial deformation. Now, does this mean they were part Nephilim? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm saying something inspired them to do this, and it wasn't a class distinction. It wasn't that the elites gave their children coneheads to set them apart from the plebes, the hoi polloi. Everybody was doing it, apparently. Now, we don't have a 100%, we can't obviously find 100% of the skeletons for every person who ever lived during that period of time. But so far, of the skeletons, the human remains that have been exhumed going back 7,000 to 10,000, 12,000 years ago, and then I'm using their dating system, of course, it appears that this was a phenomenon practiced by everybody everywhere in the ancient Near East, and something inspired them to do that. Why? Why did they decide to do that rather than, why wrap the kid's head so tightly that it deforms the skull? What were they trying to accomplish? Why do so many of their figurines, like the ones, the Ophidian figurines at Eridu, show pointy-headed reptilians? I think it's who they were worshiping. And if you look at Dr. Michael Heiser's work on the Nakash in Genesis, and the fact that the word Nakash was interchangeable in the books of Numbers and Isaiah in several places with the root word of the word seraphim, I think you're looking at angelic beings. If you want to use the English term, angel is really too confining a term. It's too broad a term, actually. It's not specific enough. But the Nakash was a seraphim, one of the seraphim. And I suspect that that was what the people were venerating. Interestingly enough, it appears that after the flood swept over, according to the Sumerian king list, the term used in the Sumerian king list, the practice pretty much disappears. Coincidence? I think not. Coming up in A View from a Bunker, we got some very interesting programs I think you'll appreciate. Carl Teichrib and Brent Miller, two more from our exclusive series of interviews recorded at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. That will be those will be released on September the 28th. Carl, always a deep thinker, and Brent Miller is a very soft-spoken gentleman, but when we interviewed him in 2014 at the Rocky Mountain Conference, the title of his talk, well, was applied to the interview that I had with Janet Phelan that was released last week, Why the Elites Want to Kill You. This interview dealt with this talk this time around, which is about how the church has basically abdicated its moral authority in modern America. Then on October 2nd, we talked with Carl Teichrib again very recently. He gave us an update on what had happened at Burning Man, the annual festival held in the Nevada desert, Black Rock, and why it is significant. We talked about transformational festivals in general. That interview will be released on October 2nd. October 5th, Wednesday, Dr. Michael Heiser. He was at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. He didn't speak, but he was there and met with a lot of folks. And while he was there, grabbed him, dragged him up to the interview room. That interview will be on the DVD set released from the conference. But you'll hear the audio of it along with the interview with Claudia Koenig. She has a ministry where she witnesses to everybody, everywhere, at any time. And I will say, you won't see it because you're only hearing the audio in the interviews that I'm releasing on this podcast, but got a bit emotional in both of those interviews, in talking with Mike and his work, and then Claudia and his work as well. And then yesterday, had the opportunity to talk to Pastor Carl Gallops, best-selling author of The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. His most recent book, Be Thou Prepared, well, book last year that we talked to him about, Be Thou Prepared, his new book is When the Lion Roars, which deals with end times prophecy. He doesn't get into setting dates, not even setting a timeline for prophecy, just looking at the prophecies that are being fulfilled in news headlines that we read every day. That interview will be released on October the 9th, and then coming up October 12th, the final interview from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, or final interviews, L.A. Marzulli and Stan Deo. You won't want to miss that one, that on October the 12th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, back on track now that we've got our hosts hosting server issues resolved. Gilberthouse.org is the website. We post two new Bible studies every week, about an hour each, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, and we're following a chronological reading order, not the order in which they're in the Bible. Those are available for you to download by midday Sunday every week, And all the archives are available online for free, going back to Genesis 1:1, gilberthouse.org. Monday means a new episode of The God Conspiracy. That's the audio version of my novel, releasing it through the YouTube channel, Derek Gilbert, or youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. But it's got its own website as well. If you want to go directly to this, just bookmark The God Conspiracy, all one word, thegodconspiracy.tk. TheGodConspiracy.tk, spinning it out over the course of about 6 months. And we're up to episode 4 coming up this Monday. Again, you'll find those released every Monday for your enjoyment, I hope, at TheGodConspiracy.tk. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes. So we're up to 65 reviews now there, and I do thank you for taking the time to do that. And the average rating of over 4.5 stars is very humbling. Thank you very much. I do appreciate that. We're also available at Stitcher and other places online. Tune in wherever you find us. We appreciate your reviews, and your comments are always welcome at our Facebook page, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.